So we're starting a new parak, ninth parak of Ksubas, Pei Gimel Amud Aleph. Still going to be talking about the, continuing the topic from the previous parak, about the disposition of the Nichsim Malug. Mostly we're going to talk about the Nichsim Malug, the Nechasim that the wife brings into the marriage, of which she owns the group of the Nechasim themselves. The husband is entitled to the payrus of them. The previous parak we talked about various when she's allowed and not allowed to sell these nichsim malug, etc. Here we're going to be dealing with more angles on that.
She determines before the marriage what's nichsim malug or what's
a. So what's brought into the marriage to begin with is if it's written into the ksuba, then it's nichsim tzayin barzel. Then in that case the husband owns them and you just have to reimburse her at the end. If they're not written into the ksuba, they're nichsim malug. So yes, in that sense, she or her father, if her father's marrying her off, is the one that is the one that determines that. Afterwards, what happens afterwards, nechasim that she gets, I think the general assumption is that they're nechasim malug, again, because they weren't written into the ksuba. So Mishnah starts up, HaKosav LeIshna, if somebody writes out a document to his wife as follows, Dinu Dvarim Ein Li B'Nechasayich, I have no din and dvarim, in other words, I have no claims against your nechasim. Well, you would think that means that he doesn't have any rights to anything from them. No, Harez Eichel Peres B'Chayah, he still gets the Peres from her Nechasim as long as she's alive, these Nichsim Malug, the Mesa Yosha, and if she dies, then he inherits the Nechasim from her. Imkein, Lama Kasav La Dinu Dvarim Ein Demi Nechasayach, so what exactly is he accomplishing by writing that I have no Din and Dvarim in your Nechasim, if anyway, he gets the Peres and he yarshens them anyway, so what exactly is he denying himself by writing this out? He's denying himself, she makra v'nosna kayim. Like this, with this document, if she sells or gives away any of these nechasim, then it's okay. What she did is effective. Previous parak, we talked about that, for example, we said if she got nechasim after she got married, then which he's entitled to the payrus, then we said that she's not that, then we said she can't sell them. Then they said she can't sell them, and we discussed even that even b'dievet, if she did, it may not be good. Here, when the husband wrote out, dinu dvarim, ein li b'nechasayich, what that accomplishes is that now she's free to sell them if she wants. But as long as she hasn't sold them, as long as she still holds on to them, then he still gets the payrus and he still yashins them.
If she gets, she inherits during the marriage,
then it becomes nichsim malug. Ordinarily, three things would apply. Number one, she can't sell them without her husband's permission. And actually, her husband can't sell them without her permission, too. Number two, neither one can sell without the other one's permission. No, he can't. That's what I'm saying. Neither one. It's nichsim malug. She can't sell it without his permission.
She's the owner of the
nichsim malug, but because he has payrus from them, because the husband's entitled to payrus from them, she can't sell them without his permission, because he's supposed to be getting payrus from them. He can't sell them without her permission, because the goof belongs to her. Fine, if they both agree, of course, you can do whatever you want. But, yeah. But so ordinarily, you have three dinim, in other words. You have number one, that neither one of them can sell it. Number two, that he gets payrus. And number three, he yarshins it after she dies. What we're saying in the mission is, if he writes out this document that says, dinu dvarim ein li b'nechasayich, then what that does is it takes away his right to object to it being sold. But it doesn't take away, he waives that. Yes, this waiver, by the way, is called, we're going to talk about it in the Gemara, it's called siluk. It's called that he's removing himself from any partial ownership of this thing. But what we're saying is he's only removing himself in that one sense, in the sense that he can't prevent her from selling it. But he still gets the payrus and he still yashins her.
If she sells, then he doesn't get the payrus.
Until she sells. Until she sells, he got her luck.
So either she leaves him or she buys later on.
Yeah. What about Kasav La Dinu Dvarim Ein Li B'Nechasayich Over Peres Sehen? What if he writes that I have no Dinu Dvarim in your Nechasim or in their Peres? So now he seems to have taken himself away from having the Peres as well. Yep, Harez Ein Eichel Peres B'Chayel. Then fine, he doesn't get to eat Peres while she's alive. However, V'Mesa Yosha. But if she dies, then he's still Yoshim. So he still has that third thing. Actually, Mephoshim discussed the issue when he says B'Nechasayich Over Peres Sehen. Is he saying that he's taking himself away both from the ability to prevent her from selling and from getting the payrus, or maybe actually on the contrary, by mentioning the chasayach of payrusayin, maybe he's specifying that he means to only take himself out of payrus. Okay, anyway. But at any rate, he definitely still yarshins her. Rabbi Hoda, I mean, he yarshins her even in the face.
Not the payrus.
No, they're talking about the keren. The payrus, obviously, he's not getting all this time. But he yarshins the keren, the land itself, or what have you, once she dies. Rabbi Yehuda says not even that. As a matter of fact, even if he wrote in this document that he's not entitled to the Nechasim or to the Peiris, he still can eat Peiret Peiris. Now, what are Peiret Peiris? We'll talk about on Amud Beis. Unless he specifically writes in the document, if he specifies, only if he specifies that, then he's off limits of Peiris, of Peiris, Peiris, and otherwise, also. What about another case? So now, if he goes further, he says, "I have no dinur dvarim, and I have no claims against your nechassim, not in your nechassim, not in the peiros, not in the peiros, not when you're alive, and not when you're dead." Well then, ain ochel peiros b'chayeh, so then he doesn't get peiros while she's alive, because he specifically mentioned that. Ve'meisa ain yosha, and also, in this case, then he has taken himself out of Yerusha. So yes, then in that case, he doesn't have any of the three. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, no. Imesa Yerushena, no. Even in that case, if she died, he still inherits her. Because for him to say that I'm not going to yarshen you, he's making a tnai against something that says in the Torah. If you make a tnai against something that it says in the Torah, then the tnai is batal. So what's Masha Kazav Torah? Rashi explains that the Tana of our Mishnah holds. Now it's this is Machloikas in Baba Basra. The fact that a husband yarshens his wife, is that Minat Torah or is that Midrabanan? So according to the Tana of our Mishnah, it's Daraisa. It's Daraisa, yeah. So the Gemara in Baba Basra mentions various possibilities on it, either that it's Daraisa or that it's a Tekhara Dirabanan. Even if it's a tachana d'rabbanan, sometimes we say we've talked about this concept before. Chachamim also chizik l'divrayim yosim mishal Torah. Chachamim strengthen the uxeris even more than something minat Torah, and therefore they won't allow you to override it. So in this case, Rav Shimon Gamliel is not saying that. But we'll talk about tomorrow. We'll talk about in tomorrow's Gemara whether that issue might come into the picture over here. Sometimes Chachamim want to make that their tachana is even stronger than the original din d'oraisa. Because the din d'oraisa, fine, it's written in the Torah. People aren't going to be careless with it. A din d'rabbanan, people may get careless with if you allow them to make a tenai against it. So what Rashi is saying is here we learn in Baba Basra, the Gemara mentions, since the pasuk says that if a person dies without any close relatives, then you give his property l'she'erei hakarev elav, to his she'er who's related to him. She'erei hakarev elav basically means his spouse. And the Gemara mentions also the Gemara mentions over there actually in Baba Basra the possibility that we do something called Gerdin or Mosifin Vedoshin, that we rearrange the letters of these three words. The expression is Satmas Nachalosai L'She'eroi. And the Gemara talks about over there that maybe you anagram the words Nachalosai L'She'eroi and make it into the words Nachalos She'eroi Loi, meaning that the Nachla of his She'er, of his wife, Loi goes to him. It's called Gerdin, that you take off a letter from one word, or Mosifin, you add it to another word, Vedoshin, and you Doshin the result.
You can do that.
It's a valid method, yeah.
You're here revenging the Torah.
Yes, so.
So, sometimes,
but that's not in terms of Integra. The Torah is written in a way that one of the ways you can Doshin it is by rearranging the words. What?
I understand that the Torah at one time was written without spaces between the words.
I don't know without spaces, but okay, okay, you know what, since you're mentioning it, I will say it briefly, and I'll tell you briefly. I think we talked about this before, that the Gemara in Baba Basra discusses the last eight psukim of the Torah, beginning from Yom HaShem Moshe. Who wrote them? I mean, Moshe couldn't have written them. It says he died. So one possibility is Yeshua wrote them. That's one man problem. That's one Tana says that. The other Tana says, I think it's Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Meir, or maybe it's the other way around, whatever. But after all, somebody had to write it in the physical Sefer Torah. So the other Tana says, wait a minute. So it says that Moshe gave a complete Sefer Torah to Levim, and he'd shave it. What happened? It says that up until then, the Eivishter would dictate every word of the Torah, and Moshe wrote it down. Here, the Eivishter is dictating it, and Moshe wrote it bedema. So what's bedema? The simple meaning is it means with tears. And he's crying while he's writing it, realizing that he's going to die. Or maybe I think the Ramaphosian would say that bedema means instead of writing with ink, he wrote it with tears. There's a vort I think I've seen from the Vilna Gaon who says that bedema means confused. Meloshin meduma, like you have turma, mixed up with cholin. means originally that the Kol HaTorah Shmosef Shal HaKadosh Baruch Hu, originally the letters of the Torah were meant to make up various names of Hashem. You know, so the same letters were in a different order than we have them now. The Eibishter dictated to Moshe, and he wrote it down, Bedema, in the mixed-up order as it existed before these, before the actual events happened. Later on, the Eibishter told Yoshua or whoever to rearrange it into the words that we have now. But we see that we see from that rearranging the letters of the Torah, hello, is a valid way of
doing.
Okay, but this is so according to the Mandamar that this is Midorai, so that's also it's one of the Midas, it's one of the Midas Shatter and Adreshes, man. Bedema meaning mixed up, yeah. This Gerunim, this isn't the only example. There was another example that we use in Halacha of Gerunim, a different Vedoshin also, but I don't remember what it is. Anyway, okay. So, the Gemara starts off. Tani Rav Chiya, ha'oimer l'ishtoi. This is that we said in the Mishnah, that the guy writes out to his wife, he says, dinu dvarim em lebin chasayich. So Rav Chiya said, not necessarily if he writes it, even if he just says it. Just saying it is good enough. That's a good enough siluk. So the question is, v'chikas of lamai havi. So even if you're writing it out, or according to Rav Chiya, you're saying it, if there's no kinyan, what good does it do? V'atanya, we learn in a braisa. Suppose that we, so what are we saying in the Mishnah? That the guy wrote out a document, or according to Rav Chiya, he said verbally, dinu dvarim eilim in chasayim. Without a kinyan, how does such a thing b'chlal help? This is one of the Rishonim, Rabbeinu Kreshkash, explains the question of the Gemara that way. The Gemara's question is, what are you telling, how is the statement, whether in writing or verbally, valid without a kinyan? V'atanya, we learn in a braisa, if a person says to another person, Rashi says we're talking about over here about you have two people who are partners in a field. They own the field jointly, and one of them says to the other, dinu dvarim ein li al sadazu, I have no dinu dvarim, I have no claims that I'm going to make against this field. The Ainli Asikva, I have no business with it. The Yodai Mistalakase Mena, and my hands are removed from it. So three different Lashonis of saying I have nothing to do with it. Loy Omar Klum, what he said doesn't count for anything, because in order for him to, if he wanted to give away his half of the field to the other guy, he would actually have to use a Lashon of Matana. I'm giving you my half of the field. This Lashon of Siluk is not considered a good Lashon to be considered that he's giving up his claim to it. We're saying that even if he says it, even if he says all three of these Lashonis, it's no good. That's the point. So how is it in our Mishnah it would be any good? Amikvei Rav Yanai. So they said in the Yeshiva Rav Yanai, because the difference is our Mishnah is talking about Bekosev Lava Oda Arusa. Because our Mishnah is talking about where he wrote, or according to Rav Chiya, he said it while she was in Arusa. The difference is in the case of the Ha'omer L'Chaveiro, you're talking about the two people are already partners in the field. So for him to be misalik, for him to do a siluk, to waive his further claims to the field, he has to do more than just waive. He actually has to give it. He actually has to give it as a matana and write out a shtar matana or something. Here we're talking about that he did it while she's in Arusa before he ever got control of these nechassim. Anyway, he has no control over them while she's in Arusa. Kedir of Kahana, and this works. No, well, it's both, really. I mean, it's both, really. I mean, it's no kinyan, and the fact if he had written a shtar matana, then fine, you have edim on it. If he had said dinu dvarim ein lemechasayach and made a kinyan, fine, the kinyan itself counts. For Sasha, we'll talk about soon whether a kinyan works. We'll get to that at the bottom of the yomud. But at any rate, here we have no kinyan and just the lashon of siluk. It's for sure no good. And the answer is there's a difference. If he says it while, if he does it while she's in Arusa, then you don't need either of those things. Siluk is enough because he doesn't have any control over the nechassim yet anyway. The nechassim haven't yet come into his possession anyway. Therefore, just siluk is good enough for him to waive his claims to them. And for the same reason, you don't need a kinyan.
So he's not waiving anything if he has no right to that.
No, because he's saying, I'm waiving my future rights.
Well, future rights doesn't mean anything.
But it does. It means... There is. No, it means he's waiving his rights to be able to claim any of the stuff in the future. That's a valid waiver. He doesn't need a Lashon Matana for that. Kidder of Kahana. And this works like the way Rav Kahana said. Da'amar of Kahana, Nachla Baal Adam Rimokma. If you have an inheritance that's going to come to somebody from a different place, meaning not, in other words, we're not talking about, for example, a son trying to waive the inheritance he gets from his father or whatever. We're talking about, for example, a case like this where he stands to inherit something from his wife. He's going to marry her, and then through that, if she dies while he's alive, he's going to inherit whatever she had. That's called Nachla Bama Makamacha, because the Nachla that sort of depends on his doing. If he chooses not to marry her, then he's not going to be in line for this Nachla. Therefore, a person can make a Tanai on that he won't inherit it. Why? Because it hasn't yet come into his hands. So therefore, the same thing. If he says this Tanai in our Mishnah before the Eirusin, same thing, it works. Incidentally, by the way, the Ran talks about the idea that we're saying over here, if he said it ba'oida arusa, the Ran says it means specifically that. If he were to make this Tanai before the Eirusin ever, then it wouldn't work. Because before the Eirusin, he and she have no shaychus at all. At least after the Eirusin, he and she have some kind of shaychus. He doesn't yet have any control over the property yet, because it still all belongs to her, but at least they have enough of a shaychus that for him to say at that point, Dibur Dvarim Ainli has an effect. That's according to that. Relax. They're not bothering us. Relax. Which, by the way, gets into an interesting question when you think about it. You know, I mean, we're talking in all of these gemaras and everything that when a couple gets married, what happens? Yeah, the wife's property comes into the marriage and becomes nixim lug. Some of it anyway becomes nixim lug if it's not written into the ksuba, and the husband is entitled to payrus from it. Have you ever heard of anybody doing that nowadays? Nowadays, I mean, a couple gets married, a wife has various things that she, you know, various presents that her friends gave her, or stuff that she owned before she was married, etc., and you never hear of the husband having a right to pay this from it. So it used to be, actually, apparently a few hundred years ago, they used to actually write out a document where the husband explicitly waives any rights to those things. I've never heard of them doing it nowadays, but I guess once it became established that he waives it, then it's assumed to be the case. And then there became a question among the Achronim, when do you write out that document in a way that it should be valid? According to the Ran, you can't do it before the Kiddushin, and when are you going to do it? You don't, between the Kiddushin and the Nisuin, are done one right after the other nowadays. It wasn't like in those days where you have a year between them. A few different answers are given. One of them is, Chassam Sofer says, the difference is, we're talking about that in those days, from the Shidduchin, from when the Shidduch was made until the Eirusin, there was no specific, nobody had made any specific deals or tnoim or whatever that they're going to get married. So yes, it was very easy, you know, things could very well be broken off. Before the Eirusin, there's no specific reason to assume that this marriage is ever b'chlal going to happen. Whereas nowadays, the Chassam Sofer says, we read out Tnoyim, they make a kinyan that they're going to get married, etc. So at that point already, that has the equivalent effect of the Eirusin. Then you can already consider it as though he has enough of a shaychus to the Nechassim that then at that point he can write out the Shtar Siluk and waive his rights. That's the point of the Chassam Sofer after the Tnoyim. It's fine. Yeah. Well, nowadays, that's true. Nowadays, we do the Tznoyim shortly before the Chuppah. In the Chassam Sofer's time, they didn't. In the Chassam Sofer's time, they did the Tznoyim long before, yeah. Nowadays, we do the Tznoyim closer, partly because of that, because we don't want, once the Tznoyim are made, we don't want the chance that things are going to get broken off. They make prenuptial agreements. Yeah, that's a similar, yeah. Okay. The Chiddur Rava, and in turn, this din of Rav Kahana is about being able to waive a nachla that's going to come to you from an outside source, is like what Rava says. The Amar Rava, ha'oimer hi efshi v'takana chachamim. If somebody says, I don't want to take advantage of the takana of the chachamim, to go in zu, like in this case, the case that we're going to mention in a minute, shemin lo, then we listen to him. So in other words, in this case, the husband can argue that, look, there's a takana chachamim that I'm entitled to pay from these nachasim, and that I'm entitled to inherit from my wife's nachasim. I choose not to exercise that Efshi means want. Efshi, I don't want, but Takana Chachamim. Mike Goinzu, what's an example like this? What's the original case that Rav is talking about? So the Rav Huna Amar Rav is the din that Rav Huna said in the name of Rav. The Amar Rav Huna Amar Rav, Yechoyla Isha Shetayma Lebaila, a woman can say to her husband, Eini Nizonis Ve'eini Oiseh. I don't want to be supported by you, and I don't want that my Maisa Yadav, that my earnings are going to go to you. We learned in a previous parak, in the fifth parak, that usually a woman's maisi adeha, she's supposed to produce a certain amount of goods, usually spinning wool or weaving or whatever the various things are, and her earnings from that go to her husband, in return for which the husband gives her mezonos. since the whole thing is a takanas chachamim, we're saying she has the option to say, you know what, I don't want to bother with that. Either Rashi says, for example, that let's say, for example, she says, I don't want to do malacha. I don't want to do malacha. I'll find some other way of supporting myself. Or she says, for example, I have a business that gets me a lot of money, a lot more than I need for my mezonos. So why should I give? You know, I'm making $500 a day. Why should I give it to my husband? And I'm gonna get $20 worth of food a day. Better I may as well keep my own earnings and I'll support myself.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the original takana is for her benefit. So if she chooses not to, yeah. So the same idea. Okay, so the question is, well, then based on that logic, if you're saying that the husband has the right to waive it, then why don't we say the same thing after she gets married? Why are we saying it only works when she's an arusa? The answer is, Amar Abaye, nesua yadoi ki yada, because the difference is, once they get married, then they have equal rights to these nechasim. He's like a partner at that point. Just like we said it in the first line of the Gemara, that if you have two partners and one of them says to the other, Dinu Dvarim Ainli, it doesn't work. You need more than Siluk, you need an actual Shtai Matana. Same thing over here. Once he's married, he becomes a partner. Rava Amar, Rava says a little differently. Yada Adifa Mi Yada. Actually, his ownership on the property is even better than hers. And what does that mean? Nafkamin lo shemeres yavam. The relevance of that is not really for our Gemara over here. The relevance of that is actually for the case of shemeres yavam. We learned in a Mishnah in the previous perek that if you have a Shemeres Yavam inherits Nechasim, so we said she's entitled to do whatever she wants with them while she's a Shemeres Yavam, then we said what happens if she dies, what do we do with the Nechasim, and there was a Machlokas Bishama Bishilo, where was it, Bishama said that you split it, the Yoshim of her husband get half of it, and the Yoshim of her side of the family get the other half of it, and Bishilo says you look at each kind of Nechasim who has the Chazaka over it. Now, in Yevamos, we learned that there was a machloikus, a four-way machloikus amaroyim, how to understand this machloikus as shama b'silol. Because the point was, why are we saying that whatever she inherited when she's a shemeres yavam, she can do whatever she wants with, whereas we're saying that if she dies as a shemeres yavam, then some of it goes to one side of the family, some of it goes to the other side. What's the difference? So we said, Abaya there in Yevamos, we learned that Abaya explained it, that the difference is, if she inherited this property while she was married to her first husband, while she was married to the first brother. So what happens? If she dies as a Shemeret, she's a Shemeret Yavam, now she died. The point is, we say that his ownership of the property and her ownership of the property are on an equal level. Well, if they're on an equal level, then Bishamai says, therefore, his side of the family gets half of it, and her side of the family gets half of it, because they're exactly equal. Whereas Basila would say that you look, Basila says, fine, I agree that each of them has an equal chazaka on the property, the husband and the wife, each one is an equal partner. Fine, then you have to look at which side has the greater chazaka on the Nichsim Malug versus Nichsim Tzen Barzel versus Ksuba, whatever. That was about.
According to the one we were learning the last few days, it sounded besides her Ksuba money and her Tzen Barzel, the money goes to her husband's family.
That's what we said, actually. That's what they were saying. It's Machloek of the Shama Basilo. What exactly happens? Whether they just split it half and half, or whether we look at Nichsed Tzon Basel separately, and Ksuba separately, and Nichsed Lemog separately. Yeah. Anyway, all that was Abaya's explanation, which is based on the idea that we say that the husband and wife are considered basically equal partners. Rava learned it differently. Rava said that if she inherited this property while she was married to her first husband, to the first brother, there's no question that he would be the one getting it. That's why Rava is saying over here his ownership of the property is stronger than hers. What's the machloikas? The Shama Basilol is actually, it has to do with the issue of whether Maimer had been done, whether the Yavam had done Kedushin Midrabanan with this Yavama before she inherited this property or not. If he didn't, then he has no...
Whether he had done Maimer with her. So the husband passed away.
She inherited the property. That's when we would say... So if she inherited it before Maimer, that's when we would say that it's hers completely to do whatever she wants with it. If it's after Maimer, that's when you'd have the machlokes of the Shama Basilol. The point is, though, that Rava is saying that as long as she's married to her husband, he has a stronger, he has his 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 ownership over the property is stronger than hers. And that's what we're saying in our Gemara over here, that when Rava and Abaya are arguing on that point, it's not really relevant to our Gemara over here about a regular husband and wife. It's more relevant to that case of Shemeres Yavam.
Coming back to the case where both passed away, actually where the husband passed away and she didn't pass away, is that dependent on whether or not you believe there's a Zika or there's no Zika?
No, because when we talk about whether there's Zika or not, that has more to do with the question of whether whether she can become possible to Yibum in certain cases or whatever. Fine, but that's the fact of the matter is when her husband died, she is a Shemeres Yavam. She's going to have to do either Yibum or Chalitza. In that sense, there, as a practical matter, there's Zika. What we argued is whether yes Zika or ain Zika as a matter of halacha, whether you're able to break the Zika. Whether you're able to do something to break the Zika, that has nothing really to do with our with this situation over here. Ibayalahu. Okay. So now the Yeshivalites had a question as follows. Konum yaday mahu. What if they made a kinyan from him? So Rashi says we're talking about that. We're going back now. Rashi says we're not talking about the case of a husband and wife. We're going back to the original case that we mentioned in the Braisa. Ha'omel ha'chaveira dinu dvarim ein le'al-sadazu. We said that doesn't count for anything. The question now is, what if instead of Jason just saying that, they actually made a kinyan on that statement? Is that effective?
Rather,
right. The question, so... They made a kinyan soda or whatever. Usually when you say something and then you confirm it with a kinyan, then that makes it binding, yes. Amar of Yosef, midinu dvarim kana biyada. It still doesn't mean that, it doesn't mean that he gave up any rights to the property. It means that he gave up any rights to... It means that he gave up any rights to argue in Beis Din about the property. But it doesn't mean he still retains his ownership over it. Rav Nachman Amar Megufa Shokalka Kana Miyada. Rav Nachman says that no. He actually means that if he says that and does a kinyan, it means that he relinquished the actual karka itself.
Very hard to argue the opposite.
Well, wait. We'll see in a second. Tosfos, by the way, learns differently. Tosfos learns that this Kana Miyada Mahu is not referring back to this case of the Shutfin. It's talking about the case of, we just said that if a husband and wife are already married, and he says, who said it doesn't help because he's a shudder. So the question is, what if they make a kinyan? That's similar. It's not because they were talking about shudfin and he was talking about a husband. Okay, it's similar. It's not identical. Okay. Amar Abaye Mistabra Milsev Rav Yosef Ba'orer. It makes logical sense to say that to agree with Rav Yosef in a case where he's objecting. Namely, you have as follows. You have Reuven and Shimon when we say that he said dinu dvarim elim and chasecha and they made a kinyan on the statement. And Rabbi Yosef is saying the kinyan, all it does is it makes it that he's not able to object in Beis Din anymore. Doesn't mean he relinquished his right to the property. So what does that mean? It means, when would we apply that? Abaya says, ba'orer. So suppose now that, so you had Reuven and Shimon owed the property. Reuven made a declaration, dinu dvarim ainli al sadazu, and he made a kinyan. So Shimon says, and so Shimon goes ahead to take over the other half of the property. If now Reuven comes and objects and says, you know what, when I said dinu dvarim ainli, all I meant is I'm not going to take you to Beis Din about it, but I'm not actually giving up my rights to the property. You can't take this over. Then that would be a logical case. That would be a logical case to apply Rabbi Yosef Din. But what happens, for example, if Reuven made this declaration, Shimon went and took over the other half of the property, a couple of days passed, and now all of a sudden Reuven comes with complaints, then it's more logical to say Migufa Shokalka Kana Miyada. Then it's more likely to say that no, to begin with, he really didn't mean to give away the property. Afterwards, somebody pointed out to him, you know what kind of an idiot were you just giving it away like that? Better you should go and try to claim it in Beis Din. So then we would assume, in other words, that he really meant to give it as a valid matana, and now he's trying to change his mind, and he can't. There would be a difference between whether we did it right away or afterwards.
Right away,
when he goes to take it over. Yeah, the pashtus. The Ritva learns differently. The Ritva has a problem with this explanation of Rashi, among other things, because where do you ever find that there's a difference like that? Their kinyan is effective when a person is taking it over right away, but not a couple of days later or whatever. So he explains, he quotes the Baal Amor, who explains it differently. Ba'ura means that if you're talking about a case where when Shimon is taking over the property, there are other people who are objecting to the kinyan, then it's logical that Rabbi Yosef is, then we would apply Rabbi Yosef's version of it, which is that he's saying, fine, there may be other people objecting, I'm not going to be one of them. As opposed to, if there's nobody objecting anyway, then the pashtus. If you're saying dinner devarim ainli, nobody's objecting anyway. What are you giving away if not for the fact that ba'oimid, you're actually just standing there in the field without anybody objecting to you taking it over? The pashtus, then it means that he gave away the actual property. So a meimer says the halacha is actually like Rav Nachman's understanding that what he gave away is the actual goof of the karka. That his waiver is on the karka itself, not just on his ability to argue in Beis Din. The goof of shakaka kana miyadi. The kinyan is on the goof of the karka itself.
So it goes against
Rav. It goes against Rav. Fine. It goes according to Rav Nachman. Amalei Rav Ashi la meimer ba'ur ba'omid. So Rav Ashi asked Amema, which case are you talking about? Are you talking about the case, as we just said, this distinction that we wanted to make, whether there's an error involved, whether there's arguments against it, or are we talking about that he's already settled in the field? And the question is, Amai Nachamina, Amema asks him, what's the difference? He says, Lechad Rabbi Yosef, I want to know whether you think that there's a case where we should apply Rabbi Yosef's din. Or are you saying across the board, like Rav Nachman? Amalei, so Amema tells him, Loi Shmieli, I haven't heard of this distinction. Kloimer, as if to say, Loi Svirali, I don't hold of this distinction. A common expression in the Gemara when an Amora says, Loi Shmieli. Yeah, there's a lot of times you find in the Gemara when an Amora says, Loi Shmieli, I haven't heard of this. He means to say, in other words, I didn't hear about it because I didn't bother with it. I don't consider it to be a valid distinction. And therefore, in other words, Amema is saying that, yeah, across the board, it's always like Rav Nachman. If the guy says, Dinu Dvarim, Ainli, and made a Kinyan, then that's it. He means that he withdrew. It means that he waived the Tauka itself, not just his ability to argue about it in Beis Din. Okay. The Mishnah continued that in the first case, when he just says, Dinu Dvarim, Ainli, Ben Chasayich, we said he's still entitled to the Peiros, and he's still entitled to Yarshin her. And the Mishnah said, in Kain Lomakos of Lachola, so what exactly did he accomplish by writing out Dinu Dvarim? And the answer is he accomplished that now he can't prevent her from selling it. The question is, the Tamele Mikol Mili Flekas Nafshach. Why can't she argue in Beis Din? Look, you wrote out a document, Dinu Dvarim Ainli Ben Chasayich, and now you're trying to claim that it still means you're entitled to Peiros and entitled to Yerusha. Why? Let's take it at face value. It means that you took yourself out of everything. Amar Abaya. So Abaya says, because we have a general rule in halacha, yad bala shtar al tachtoina, the one who has the shtar in his hand has the lower hand, meaning that they have the lesser claim, kind of. Meaning, so if you have, in other words, so you have Reuven has a chazaka on something. Reuven is muchzik, let's say, in some money. Shimon brings out a shtar that shows that, let's say, Reuven owes him money or something. We say yad ba'al shtar ala tachtoina means that if what it says in the shtar, if the terms in the shtar are not perfectly clear, then we say the owner of the shtar is only entitled to the minimum understanding of the shtar. The Gemara gives examples of it in the last parak above a basra. Let's say, for example, the guy has a shtar that says that you owe me coins, plural, then you're only entitled to zuzim, let's say, without specifying a number. Then you're only entitled to two zuzim, for the mir knabim shnayim.
As opposed to the
other guy is muchzik in the money, so it's stronger. So here, similarly, similarly, there's the idea that he has the takanas chachamim that he's supposed to be entitled to three things to prevent her from selling, to get the payers, and to inherit. She wants to argue that the shtar means that he's waiving all three rights, but the shtar doesn't say that. So therefore, we take the shtar at minimum understanding. The minimum is to assume that he only waived one thing, not three.
Amoytzi
mechavel of a raya, basically. Actually, having said that...
Then if you say the shtar is only one, then he doesn't have the yada tachtena.
No, yad ba'al shtar tachtena means, in other words, instead of assuming that we should assume, instead of assuming that the shtar means the maximum, assume that it means the minimum. So the minimum is that he only withdrew from one thing. Out of three.
So it's not yada tachtona.
That's ala tachtona. It means that she has the lower hand. It means that she is only entitled to claim one that he waived one out of three things, meaning that he's entitled to claim that he has the other two. You're saying that you're saying it's a matter of a motzim chamila baraya. That is there is actually another understanding of it also. There's an interesting explanation brought about it in Kovitz Shurim from Rabbi Hanan Wasserman. He says the reason why you have the general rule Yad Ba'al Ashtar Al Hatayna is what we say. We're saying the Ashtar itself is unclear. You could understand it a certain way, you could understand it a more expansive way. The thing is, what you're saying. Let's say, for example, in the case of the zuzim, he's saying two, he's saying five. Let's say, effectively, what it is the other three zuzim are not written in the shtar. If they're not written in the shtar, they don't have the din of a shtar. Therefore, so it's not just a matter of hamotzi mechaber l'varaya. It's a matter of the shtar itself only implies two. It doesn't imply five. The other three are effectively not written in the shtar. Same thing over here. The shtar only implies that he waived one right. It does not imply that he waived the other two rights. Therefore, you can't assume that the Baal HaShtar has any rights to those things.
Unless he specifically mentioned that he waived all the three.
Okay, so now the question is, that was the last case of the Mishnah, where he said that I'm withdrawing from Peiris and Peiris and Yerushalayim. Okay, the question is, how do you know which of the three, the Emim and Peiri? Maybe say that he withdrew from getting the Peiris. Maybe he meant to hold on to the right to prevent her from selling, but he's not he plans to not get Peiris. Amar Abaya, butzina tov mikara. A small pumpkin is better than a large pumpkin. Which means Rashi says like this. Let's say Reuven says to Shimon, you can go and pick a pumpkin from my garden. You have your choice. You can either pick it now when it's small and not completely ripe, or it's ripe, but it's still smaller. Or you can wait until it gets bigger, like one of these big zucchinis or whatever. You can get it when it's small, or you can wait another couple of months and it'll be bigger and take it then. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, as we say in English. You'd rather have the small one now rather than wait and get the big one later. The nimshal over here is, the point is, he would rather have the peiros, which is a constant thing. He can get the peiros right now, as opposed to the ability for her to sell the field, which is something that could only happen later, that's likely to only happen later. So we should assume, if he's going to waive one right without specifying which one, we should assume that he's more willing to waive the ability to prevent her from selling the field, which is something far in the future, rather than the peiros, which is right now. Tosfos explains this butzina and kara differently. Tosfos says that butzina and kara are actually two different types of vegetables. One is cucumbers and one is pumpkins. Similar idea though, that instead of if you give the guy a choice, take a cucumber now, which ripens faster, or a pumpkin later, which will take longer to ripen, you'd still rather have the cucumber right now. Similar idea. Okay. How about the Emma Yerusha? Okay, how do you know he didn't waive the ability to Yarshin from her? Amar Abaya, Misa Shchicha Mechira Lo Shchicha. The difference is that she should die is a much more common thing. Why? Tosfos says because women give birth, and it's very common for women to die in childbirth, or at least it was in those days. It's much more likely that she's gonna die Mechira Lo Shchicha, and less likely that she's gonna sell the field. Usually, a person doesn't want to sell the field that they inherited from their ancestors. We learned in a previous parak about the concept of shvach be'saviya, that it's good for her family reputation that they keep their estate. So she'd much rather not have to sell it. So it's much more likely that he's going to yarshin from her than that she's going to want to sell it and he would want to block the sale. So again, we should assume that he's giving away the right that's less likely. Which the Chida points out in one of his Sfarim that sometimes the Gemara talks about that Misa is not Shchicha, and then we've learned various Gemaras about that Misa is not such a common thing. Okay, but it really depends relative to what. In and of itself, Misa is not so common. Of course, eventually everybody dies, but that a person should die within a certain period of time. Let's say we learned in Yoma, for example, that the Kohen Gadol, let's say, according to the Chachamim, does not have to have a wife in reserve in case his wife dies during Yom Kippur, because it's not very likely that she's going to die just punked on that day of Yom Kippur. We had a few blocks ago, we had the idea that not necessarily is a shivcha going to die so soon, and you'd only have the vlad, etc. But on the other hand, relative to mechira, which is even rarer, yes, misa can be considered common. Okay. So therefore, b'chi masalik inish nafshi m'milsa b'lo shchicha. So it's more likely that a person is going to waive his rights, is going to withdraw from the ability to exercise his rights with something that's not common. M'milsa b'lo shchicha le masalik inish nafshi, something that's more common a person is not going to so easily withdraw from. Rav Ashi says a different answer. I can tell you how we know that he's only giving up the rights to prevent the sale and not the peiros and not the yerusha. Look at the actual words. He says bin chasayich. He says that I'm waiving my right to your nechasim, implying v'loy v'perasein. I'm not waiving any rights to the peiros. And bin chasayich, your nechasim, implying v'loy v'achamisa. Not after you're dead, when they're not your nechasim anymore. So therefore, that word itself, bin chasayich, itself implies that it means dafka, the ability to prevent her from selling it. The Mishnah had said, Rabbi Yehuda Amar Lo Ha'orecha Peira Peiris, that he can always continue eating Peira Peiris, unless he specifically mentions Peira Peiris ad Olam. So what are Peira Peiris? Tana Rabbanan, Elohim Peiris, Elohim Peira Peiris. What are Peiris and what's Peira Peiris? If she brought into the marriage karka as nixim alug and it produced peiris, karein peiris, that's the regular case of peiris. Macha peiris, v'lokach man karka, what if he sold the peiris and used that to buy land, as we talked about in the previous peiris, cases where you're supposed to do that, v'asa peiris, and that land produced food, karein peiris, and that's what we call peiris. By the way, we mentioned in the previous peiris, by the way, we said that the husband is not entitled to peiris. So how does that fit with our Gemara over here? So Tosfos said the difference is over there, Peira Peiris that we talked about over there was the case, for example, where the animal, the Vlad, was stolen, and now you have Teshlumei Kefil. Teshlumei Kefil are coming completely out of left field. They're not something that normally are produced by an animal. Therefore, that's not the kind of Peira Peiris that the husband's entitled to. Whereas here, we're talking about something that happens in the normal course of things. The Rif explains differently. The Rif explains that normally the husband is not entitled to Peira Peiris anyway. When is he entitled to them? If he never used the Peiris. If the Peiris got sold and used to buy cowco or whatever, then he's entitled to Peira Peiris. But if he himself actually benefited from the Peiris, then he's not entitled to Peira Peiris. That's how the Rif holds.
Benefit means eating.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Not necessarily. No, you would think that maybe he... No, because you would think that's what...
He used the Peiris?
No, but the point would be, according to the Rif, if he did use the Peiris, then he can't have the Peira Peiris. If he did use the payers, and some of them are left over, as we'll talk about later in the Gemara,
right.
and those payers later on are used to buy land, and then payers comes from that, then according to the Rif, he wouldn't be entitled to those. Okay. Only if all the payers were used to buy karka, and then that karka produced payers, that's payer payers.
But if some payers were not used to buy karka,
then and he benefited from those payers, and the Rif would say he can, yeah.
And the other person?
The other person would say, yeah.
Well, the payers left over, Lamar $4,000 worth of payers.
Yeah.
And he needs $700 the year to live. So he's left over $300 at the end of the year.
Right.
Is he obligated to go buy more land with that?
Well, not he would be obligated anyway. It would be she would be obligated. According to the idea that he's entitled to payers, then yes. She would be obligated to sell that land. Actually, we'll talk about that at the end of the.
Buy with the additional money.
Yeah, well, you know what? Let's wait a little bit, and we'll talk about it at the end of today's Gemara.
So you go to buy a car and you just replant it.
That's not considered payer to payer.
It's still be
payer. If the pasture is still be payer, yeah. Because the cow care itself belongs to her. So now they had a question. Little Yehuda, Peret Peres Davka, Oduma Ad Olam Davka, Oduma Tavayu Davka. Look at Rabbi Yehuda's wording in the Mishnah. He says, unless you write Peret Peres Ad Olam, then you're entitled to Peret Peres. What if you only wrote one of them? Is it the main thing is you have to write Peret Peres, and it doesn't matter whether you wrote Ad Olam, or that you have to write Ad Olam, and it doesn't matter if you wrote Peret Peres, or maybe you have to write both of them in order for it to be in effect. So let's look at the possibilities. So let's first consider, if you say that writing peira peiris is the main thing, ad olam lomali, then you'd have to ask, well, why would the Mishnah even have to mention the word ad olam? And the answer would be, hakamash malan, given the cause of la peira peiris, because the Mishnah would be telling us then that once he wrote peira peiris, kiman de cause of la ad olam domi, that's the equivalent of writing ad olam. In other words, maybe the Mishnah means you have to write it peira peiris, and once you wrote peira peiris, then that includes the idea ad olam. You know, we wouldn't say, in other words, if we look at it that way, we wouldn't say that he says peira peiris, but maybe peira peira peiris he is reserving the rights to. No, we would say that's good enough. Yeah.
So in the document itself, you won't have to say ad olam, right?
According to that way of looking at it, yeah. That's one possibility. That's one possibility of understanding what Rabbi Yehuda is saying. Peira peiris would automatically mean ad olam. V'im timtzalem ad olam davka, or you could look at it that if you're going to say that the important thing is to write ad olam, peira peiris lomali, then why would the Mishnah have mentioned the word peira peiris? Then, and the answer would be, hakamash malan, afagab de kosev la peira peiris, because even if you write the words peira peiris, you still, e kosev la ad olam, ein iloi loi. Nevertheless, you have to write ad olam. According to the second way of looking at it, ad olam you have to write no matter what. Peira peiris, if you want, you can write it. If you want, you don't have to. The important point would be that you write ad olam. And v'im chimsalem etavayu davka, or you could say that maybe the Mishnah means you have to write both things. And the question is, kauji lomali, what would you need both expressions? Tzricha. The reason is you would need both of them. The ikasavla peyra peyras, like kasavla ad olam, because if you only wrote the word peyra peyras without adding the word ad olam, have amina, then I would think if he means peyra peyras or delay ochil, he means I'm not going to have the second level peyras, aval peyra, the peyra peyras ochil, but maybe he still reserves the right to the third level ones. So you have the peyras for the original field was sold, you bought a second field with them, that grew peyras, he sold those peyras and then bought more karka, maybe he reserves the right to those. So therefore, according to that way of looking at it, therefore you'd have to say ad olam as well. The e cost of la ad olam, conversely, if you only wrote ad olam, the cost of la peyra peyras, and you did not write anything about peyra peyras, have I mean la olam a peyras, koi. You would think that maybe the word ad olam is referring not to the peyras in the few, not to the second and third and whatever level peyras. You're actually talking about these peyras themselves. What does that mean? Yeah, the first peyras themselves. Maybe he means to say, in other words, that maybe he would be saying that. Maybe he would be saying that I won't eat these peyras, these
forever.
But peyra peyras, I'm still reserving the right to. Ad olam doesn't necessarily have to mean future generations of peyras. It could mean these particular peyras from this field I won't eat.
That's
if we say that you have to write both peyra peyras and ad olam. It's just peyra peyras, and according to that way of looking at it, that's why you would have to say both expressions. I saw an interesting thing on this, by the way. If we're discussing over here, that, first of all, who is the halacha like? Is the halacha like Rabbi Yehuda, or is the halacha like the Chachamim? So most poskim say, since the Gemara, usually we would think the halacha like the Chachamim. Most of the Rishonim say, though, that since the Gemara is discussing over here Rabbi Yehuda's opinion, and we have a usual rule, whoever opinion the Gemara delves into to try and figure out the details of the halacha is like, so most of them say the halacha is like Rabbi Yehuda. So I saw an interesting thing that this is relevant to a question of the wording and davening. We say every morning in Birkas HaTorah, we say, V'harav Na'ashem Alekeinu, B'niyah Anachnu V'tzetzeinu, V'tzetzei Kol Am Chabez Yisrael. That's in our Nusach. In Nusach Ashkenaz, they say V'tzetzeinu, V'tzetzei Tzetzeinu, and the descendants of our descendants. So they say that's relevant, that seems to be relevant, that seems to be relevant to our Machlokes over here. Does Peiris automatically include Peiris? Well, then Tzetzeinu automatically includes Tzetzei Tzetzeinu. That's our shita. Or if peyrus, if you need to mention peyrus specifically, then you would also need to say that. Sorry,
where did you read that?
I saw it in one of the in State Sofa in one of the Sfarim.
One of those mentioned the fourth flow and the fifth flow.
No, because well, I saw, by the way, another interesting thing on this that was saying that ad olam. When you get down to it, we're saying what are we saying that even if he says ad olam. Rabbi Yehuda is saying over here in the Mishnah that if he says that I'm not entitled to peyrus or peyrus ad olam, then it means that he's not entitled to them while she's alive, but he can still inherit them after she dies. That's the implication of the Mishnah, right? That only if he writes the chayayich of a moisach when you're alive or when you're dead, then he doesn't yashin her, but otherwise he would. Now, the pasuk says that by Kriyas Yamsuf, the Eved Shter, the Jewish people are afraid of the Mitzrayim. The Eved Shter tells Moshe to tell them, "Don't worry, loisa sifin lo oisam oid ad olam. You'll never see him again. You'll never see him again." Wait. So the Zohar says, "What about it? The Vayari Yisrael of Mitzrayim? They saw them dead by the seashore." And the answer is, that's not ad olam. Means they're not going to see them alive. There's no problem them seeing them dead. So somebody asked the question, how does that fit with our Gemara over here? You're saying over here that even if you write ad olam, then even if you write ad olam, it means that after she's dead, he is able to inherit her over here. And they give a very interesting answer by the Mitzrayim. Once they're dead, they're dead. They have no future. There's no tchias and mesim, no nothing. Therefore, yes, ad olam for them means only as long as they're alive. Once they're dead, that's it, forever. As opposed to our Gemara over here, ad olam means it. So I forgot to mention, I'm sorry, one detail that's important over here to this. Tosfos explains the point of the ad olam is not that he's saying, let's say, I'm not going to eat the first level peyrus, but I still reserve the right to the second level peyrus. No, what he means is, if we would think, if he only says peyrus and doesn't say ad olam, or if he doesn't, or if he only says ad olam and doesn't say peiros, sorry, that he means these peiros I won't even eat after you're dead. Other peiros, peiros, I'm still reserving the right to. That's why you have to say peiros. If he doesn't, if he says ad olam, but doesn't say peiros, then it means these peiros from this field, even after you're dead, I'm not going to eat them. But as opposed to, that's why you have to say peiros. And ad olam Tosfos says, so that's the point of the question is, so therefore we see ad olam is still after she's dead. How does that fit with that zayah? Well, the difference is because goyim, once they're dead. That's it. As opposed to a yid that's chiyas amesim. So therefore, the ad olam, yes, she's dead right now, but still, she has a future. So you still have to say that the peiros are off limits. And yeah. Yeah. Right. What? What does
it mean?
Yeah. Okay. Iboilahu. Okay. Now they had another question. Kosovlo, what if the husband writes like this? What if he specifically mentions the nechasim and the peir peiros, but he does not mention the peiros? Our Mishnah has talked about, he says, I have no dinu dvarim in the nechasim and in the peiros. And we have the machalik, the Sura Behuda and the chachamim, where the peiros includes peir peiros. Here it's the other way around. He mentioned peir peiros and he left out peiros. Then is he allowed to eat the peiros of that particular field? On the one hand, we can argue he didn't remove himself, he removed himself only from peiros, not from peiros. Or do we call milik solik nafshu? Maybe he removed himself from everything. The answer is pshitah. Call milik solik nafshu. It seems obvious that he means that he removed himself from everything, peiros as well. Because simple, the yamet peiros solik nafshu and peiros solik nafshu. If you're going to say he only waived peiros and not peiros. If he eats the peiros, where is there going to be peiros from? The whole point is, if he's saying that by him saying I'm waiving my rights to peiros implies there's going to be peiros. But if he eats all the peiros, there is no peiros.
He eats what he needs and he'll
leave. The Gemara asks back, "Vili Taimeich, nu, according to your Svara, Hazitnan, what about this that we said in the Mishnah of Yehuda Omer Lo'olam Orecha Peiros Chola, that if he says, I'm waiving my rights to Peiros, then he can still have Peiros. Again, you have to ask, Kibindach Lunu Peiros, once she ate the Peiros, because if he's saying, I waive my rights to the Peiros, means she eats all of them, Peiros Mehecha, so where is he getting Peiros from anyway for the Yehuda to argue that he still has the rights to them? Ela B'Deshaira, obviously we have to be talking about a case where she left some of them over. Hachanami b'deshayer is the same thing over here. We could say that we're talking about he left some over. So there's no proof. And by the way, this that we're saying b'deshayer, the Rambam actually holds that you were asking about the question: do we, if there was extra payers, do we make her sell them and buy karka, etc.? The Rambam says yes. Even if he said dinu dvarim elim and chasayich were payers, that we still, because he's entitled to payers. Because the Rambam passes like Rabbi Hoda, since he's entitled to pay her peiros, we will make her leave over some of the peiros. We'll make sure she doesn't spend them all or eat them all or whatever. We'll make sure that she leaves some of them over, uses that to buy karka in order that the husband should have pay her peiros. And even further, if he says, according to the Rambam also, if he says peiros and pay her peiros, he's still entitled to pay her peiros. Again, according to Rabbi Hoda, because according to Rabbi Hoda, he'd have to say ad olam. So therefore, same idea. If he waived the peiros and peiros, same idea. We'll make her sell some of the peiros, buy land, so that there can be peiros, and he'll have that, etc. Unless he actually writes out ad olam.
You can't pay peiros. It has to be a different entity, or let's say there is a length of the time period.
No, it has to be a different entity. It has to be a different keren. It has to be a different property that belongs to her. Yeah. Because nifsim alur can be anything. It can be karka, we talked about before. It can be karka, it can be an animal that you milk, it can be an eved that you use the services. It can be a gold mine, it can be clothes that he wears, etc. Yeah, anything where you have is the object itself, and then you have the use of the object. You have the Karen versus Paris, yeah.